Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the law closing in on the Trump Organization, with indictments expected soon on failures to pay taxes on gifts, as well as much larger matters, and speak with David K. Johnston, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter who has uncovered so many tax dodges that he has been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. The co-founder of DCReport.org, where he has an article, How Trump's Toothless IRS Let the Rich Off Easy, and another also at Raw Story. Raw Story uncovers a huge tax secret favor for the super wealthy, joins us. We will discuss how a former Beverly Hills tax avoidance lawyer for the super rich, Charles Reddick, who Trump made IRS commissioner, appears to be going after a 50% increase in the enforcement of gift and estate tax law, where cheating is rampant, but is in fact doing the opposite. Meanwhile, IRS audits on the wealthiest Americans have plummeted from 1 in 5 to 1 in 700. Then we look into a critical infrastructure need for the future and speak with Nick Lutze, who directs the International Council on Clean Transportation's Electric Vehicle Program and manages its role as a secretariat for the International Zero Emissions Vehicle Alliance. He joins us to discuss his new study at the International Council on Clean Transportation, Power Play, evaluating the U.S. position in the global electric vehicle transition, and explain how, in contrast to a lot of hype, the U.S. is falling behind China and Europe in investments in electric vehicle production. Then finally, with rising sea levels from global warming emerging as a major factor in the collapse of the apartment building in Florida, in which 150 residents still remain missing, we'll speak with Xiongren Peng, a professor and director of the International Center for Adaptation Planning and Design in the Department of Urban Planning at the University of Florida, who conducts research in adaptation planning for climate change like sea level rise and extreme weather. We'll discuss how this 40-year-old building was not constructed with materials to stand up to saltwater intrusion that corrodes concrete and steel foundations. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. A 13-year veteran of the New York Times, he won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, that he's uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States. And he's the co-founder of DCReport.org, where he has an article, How Trump's Toothless IRS Let the Rich Off Easy, and another also at Raw Story. Raw Story uncovers a huge secret tax favor for the super wealthy. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnston.
Well, thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, David. And in the context of what's happening in New York with the Manhattan DA working along with the New York State Attorney General, there's an expectation that there may be indictments against members of the Trump Organization. My understanding is that the Manhattan DA was enabled to flip the accountant Weisselberg, but his family might be cooperating, in particular this daughter-in-law. So my understanding, though, in terms of this extraordinary article that you have at Raw Story uncovers a huge secret tax favor for the super wealthy, that, just to quote from your article, what makes this Trumpian scheme diabolical, that on the surface, it appears to be a 50% increase in enforcement of gift and estate tax laws, areas where cheating is rampant, Actually, it does the opposite. So isn't the Manhattan DA looking into some activities in terms of gifts in particular vis-a-vis the investigations into the Trump Organization?
The Manhattan District Attorney has been looking into whether Ivanka, Donald's older daughter, improperly received a gift on which no gift tax was paid. She was an employee of the Trump Organization, but she was paid a consulting fee, and that is inherently suspect. If it's a gift, there's no tax deduction to the business, and at this point in life, Donald has almost certainly used up all of his gift tax exemptions for his children. So he would owe gift tax on it. And that's one of many things that I'm sure they have found in the books and records of the Trump Organization. Donald, after all, has a well-documented history of just fabricating documents and making things up. And in New York State, that can get you 25 years.
Well, they'd better have a pretty solid case, don't you think, David? Because Trump's base are quite incendiary and angry, and that's the glue that holds them together, this sort of inchoate anger and delusion they all have and which he shares and which he stokes. So do you think it's going to be a strong enough case to so that people will understand that this is not, as Trump will characterize it, a witch hunt?
Well, he will characterize anything as a witch hunt. The indictment we're about to see is not the only indictment. The purpose of this indictment is to get Alan Weisselberg, who essentially runs the Trump Organization and has been doing Donald's dirty work all these years, to break with Donald and cooperate with the state. If he doesn't, I'm sure they have oodles of evidence on him that will justify a prison term that for a 73-year-old man amounts to life in prison. If they have to go all the way to trial and conviction in order to get Weisselberg to recognize what's happening, he'll pay a higher price. He might right now get a get-out-of-jail-free card. If he forces this to trial, they probably will say, you're still going to serve 5 years, for example, which would mean 3 years in New York as a practical matter. This is essentially a game of making sure that when they go with the big case that's coming, and I believe that will be a New York State racketeering charge, along with a host of other charges, that they've done everything they can to get people to flip on Donald. Alan Weisselberg has worked for the Trumps since he was in his 20s. He has done Donald's bidding all these years. He is essentially a psychological captive of Donald. And if you work for Donald for any long period of time, you will be compromised. He will get you to do things that make you vulnerable so that you have to do what he tells you to do.
And again, I'm speaking with David K. Johnston, who's the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump, a 13-year veteran of the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 2001 for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and he has uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States, and he is a co-founder of DCReport.org, where he has an article, How Trump's Toothless IRS Let the Rich Off Easy. And another, also at Raw Story uncovers a huge secret tax favor for the super wealthy. So let's talk about this extraordinary tax favor for the super wealthy that you've uncovered that's at both DC Report and at Raw Story, which apparently the White House doesn't know about. You or Raw Story contacted the White House to tell them essentially that they've only got a few days before this new law goes into effect on July the 1st, and it is a wolf in sheep's clothing. It pretends to be looking in, as I read earlier, it pretends to be imposing a 50% increase in enforcement on gift and estate tax laws, but it actually does the opposite. So explain to us, if you will, David, who's behind this and what this wolf in sheep's clothing does.
Sure. First of all, it's not a law, it's a policy.
Right.
Under Donald Trump and his commissioner of the IRS, Charles Rettig, who was a very prominent lawyer in Beverly Hills representing tax cheats, his job was to help people legally do all they could, and in some cases protect them when they'd done things beyond that, and negotiate settlements for people. So we've been very suspicious of him all the way along, even though he insists he's actually there to fix the tax system. Well, Mr. Rettig wants to hire 71 more people to examine gift tax returns and estate tax returns. There's only 137 people at the IRS who do this. 15 years ago, there were more than twice as many, in fact, 2.5 times as many, who did this kind of work. So adding 70 people sounds great. That's a 50% increase from today. The problem is the current people who do this work are lawyers who are trained in how trusts operate, how partnerships operate, and contract law. They would instead be replaced by people with much lesser skills that they're calling specialists. These people don't have the fundamental legal training that's necessary for this, and yet they would get the same pay as the lawyers. So as I characterized it, Ian, they are taking colonels and hiring in their place, or to supplement them, corporals, but they're going to give the corporals colonel pay. Who pays more money for less skill? Nobody. And that's what makes it clear that this is really a scheme to help the wealthiest tax avoiders and evaders get off, because the new people they're going to hire will not have the skill and to understand layer upon layer of partnership and trust and interconnecting obligations that are designed to turn billions of dollars into pennies when the IRS looks at the documents. And this is a sort of typical Trump stuff. You know, you sell that you're doing something fantastic when in fact, you're flushing the toilet.
Well, Biden's only got a few days to, first of all, he doesn't know about it. Does Janet Yellen know about it?
Well, they know about it by now because I called them and they got back to me. They haven't taken any action. Now, at DC Report, where this is our lead story, we run something called an action box. Raw Story is our partner. They distribute our stories first, and then we do them ourselves. And they pay for a lot of our journalism by getting the one-day advance. But we have something called an action box. What you can do. So if you go to dcreport.org, we show you how in a minute you can tell the Biden administration what you think about this. And if enough people call the White House or fill out the email form for White House comment, they will change their policy about this, which at the moment seems to be, we got other fish to fry. In the past, our readers have gotten twice Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York to change his policy. And we've gotten the heads of some of the federal agencies when Trump was president to withdraw plans that they had and shelve them. So ordinary people can have a real impact, but they have to act. That's one of the principles of DC Report that we talk about in our About page. The other journalists of my generation were all in our 70s or late 60s who started this. We believe that it's our government, we own the government, and too many of us act like renters or squatters. And as a result, people who do act like they own the government are turning it into an instrument to make them rich at your expense. And the only way to change that is people have to behave like citizens, or as we put it, like owners.
Well, how long are we stuck with this Beverly Hills tax avoidance lawyer, Charles Rettig, who Trump appointed as the IRS commissioner?
He has a 5-year appointment, but he can be removed. But what's more important than whether he is removed or not is just stopping this policy. The reason that they are not hiring lawyers is that under some arcane civil service rules, to do this kind of work, with lawyers, as it's been done for at least 54 years and maybe longer, they need to get a waiver from the general counsel of the Treasury Department that says it's okay to hire lawyers instead of non-lawyers. The IRS is actually in two agencies. The legal side is called the chief counsel, and the administrative and law enforcement side is the what we think of as the IRS. And the chief counsel's office doesn't like lawyers working on the other side of the street. So the Treasury Department has always said, yeah, this is such specialized work. You can hire lawyers to do this because of the skill level that's required. Well, Donald Trump's Treasury Department said, no, we're not going to give you permission to do that. All Biden has to do, or Janet Yellen has to do, is say, we give you permission. It's a one phone call operation. And if they don't do it, it means that Joe Biden is allowing Trump policy to give more and more tax favors to the super wealthy to become his policy. And he was very clear when he ran for office. He recognized and said our tax system is unfair, which it is. He didn't go quite as far as I do. He didn't call it a subsidy system for the super wealthy, but he said it's unfair and that he was going to seek higher taxes on people who make over $400,000 a year and that no one making $400,000 or less would pay more in taxes. Well, in this case, he isn't violating the policy on the $400,000 because the people we're talking about who will benefit from this are worth hundreds of millions or billions or tens of billions of dollars. But he is violating his promise to reduce unfairness in the system. The IRS has admitted, in fact, Reddig has been among the people who have admitted that the IRS doesn't have the capacity as it is to understand all of the sophisticated tax avoidance devices that Wall Street and trust and estates lawyers have created. And as you mentioned in introducing me, you know, 20 years ago in the New York Times, 25 to 15 years ago, I was exposing these devices, showing how they worked in plain English so that people could understand them. And for Biden to allow this to go forward is allowing Trump to set his tax policy. It would be an absolute abomination. I don't know whether he will do the right thing or not, but if he doesn't, I think he is appropriately due a lot of criticism because this isn't using up an enormous amount of political capital to achieve something or undo something Trump did. It's simply saying, Treasury, grant the waiver.
It's making a phone call. That's all it is.
It's one phone call from the White House, and Biden doesn't even have to make it. Ron Klain can make it. Somebody in the domestic policy office can make it and simply say, grant the waiver. That's all I have to do. Grant the waiver.
So just in closing then, David K. Johnson, what is going on with Reddick? Is he really, as I described him, as a wolf in sheep's clothing? Because he's made a lot of public statements about the IRS tax gap. That's the gap between what is paid by taxpayers and what should be paid. It's estimated to be, what, $381 billion?
$441 gross and then $381 net, yeah.
Right. But since Reddick's been there, and he was put in there by Trump, and his whole career has been as a gun for hire for the super wealthy to avoid paying taxes, the number of audits on the wealthiest Americans has plummeted from 1 in 5 to just 1 in 700. So doesn't that tell a story?
Yes, it does, although that happened just as he was coming into office, but it was on Trump's watch. And indeed, under Donald Trump, the amount of additional tax recommended for people who make on average $30 million a year, if you can even imagine $30 million a year, the amount of extra tax recommended was $5.4 million. That's not for one taxpayer. That's for all 26,517 taxpayers who make $30 million a year. And the number of audits just collapsed to nothing. There's been a complete collapse, basically, of auditing of the super wealthy. By the way, the working poor, there are fewer audits, too. But the ratio has only slipped a little bit. So they pulled back a little bit on the working poor, but gone to virtually no audits of the super wealthy. And by the way, all of this is disclosed in an IRS report. No other journalist in America has written about it because there's no press release except saying, here's this report, and you have to go into the detailed tables in the report and analyze them to understand what's in them. Reddig holds himself out as the champion of fixing the IRS. He has said he thinks that the actual tax gap is not around $400 billion, but $1 trillion or more. That would mean that roughly 25% of the taxes that should be paid are not being paid. And that would be overwhelmingly by wealthy business owners and investors. Because if you're a wage earner or a pensioner, the government knows your income, and you almost nobody can itemize anymore, so there's no way to cheat. You're absolutely fully taxed. So it's wealthy people who are the beneficiaries of this. And is he really doing anything about it? Well, you know, he won't sit down for an interview with me. Every other IRS commissioner, you know, I've sat in their offices, I've eaten tuna fish sandwiches with them. In one case, I yelled at one of them and he yelled back at me. But he doesn't talk. And that's typical of the Trump people. It's like Elaine Chao when she was Treasury Secretary. She would talk to Chinese language, government-owned, quote-unquote, news organizations from China, but not American journalists. And so
it's the same with the Postmaster General, too.
Absolutely. And all of this makes me very suspicious of what he's done, given his background. I'm perfectly prepared for documents to come out someday that say, no, he really was doing the right thing. But absent some real proof of that, I think it's more than reasonable to be suspicious. And in this particular case, we know from emails that I have that there was a fight inside the IRS to make sure that qualified people examined the gift and tax returns of the billionaire class, and those people lost. So, and the IRS suggested to me when they had an executive call me to talk about it, that, well, he didn't really have his involvement in this. It was way too far below him. And I just said, no, when you're the boss, you're responsible for everything. My wife's the head of an organization. She can't go in and say, oh, no, it was one of my, you know, somebody below me who did this. You're responsible for it.
Well, David K. Johnson, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter and a best-selling author of The Making of Donald Trump. A 13-year veteran of the New York Times, he won the Pulitzer Prize for reporting that uncovered loopholes and inequities in the U.S. tax code, and he's uncovered so many tax dodges that he's been called the de facto tax enforcement officer of the United States, and he's the co-founder of DCReport.org, where he has an article, How Trump's Toothless IRS Let the Rich Get Off Easy, and another also at Raw Story. Raw Story uncovers a huge secret tax favor for the super wealthy. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into a critical infrastructure need for the future and discuss how, in spite of a lot of hype, the U.S. is falling behind China and Europe in investments in electric vehicle production. Look. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Nick Lutze, who directs the International Council on Clean Transportation's Electric Vehicle Program and manages its role as the Secretariat of the International Zero Emission Vehicle Alliance. Previously, with the California Air Resources Board, he participated in the regulatory development of the 2004 and the 2012 greenhouse gas emissions regulations for automobiles, and he's the co-author of a new study at the International Council on Clean Transportation, Power Play, evaluating the U.S. position in the global electric vehicle transition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Nick Lutze.
Thank you.
So the finding, though, in your new report indicates that only 5% of the global electric vehicle investment will go to U.S. electric vehicle assembly plants. So the U.S. appears to be slipping behind China and Europe quite dramatically, yet we're hearing talk of, you know, GM and other American car makers getting into the electric car business. And we know that this has been a part of Biden's plan for infrastructure, but it's not necessarily a part of the deal that he made with the Republicans, which is a little shaky since he sort of misspoke a little and had to do a little bit of a repair job. But as far as I know, in terms of the infrastructure bill that was negotiated with Republican senators and Democratic senators, there's nothing much in there in terms of electric vehicle stimulus to get more electric cars on the road. I think there's some money in there, $7.5 billion for about 500,000 charging stations on freeways, but that's about it. So let's start with the infrastructure bill. Is this simply too little, or is the real issue going to be dealt with in a subsequent bill that he might pass through budget reconciliation?
That's a great question, Ian. I think it's safe to say that the bipartisan infrastructure bill would amount to a good start and a decent down payment towards what is needed to really pave the way for the transition to electric vehicles. What would be needed to really put the U.S. back in a technology leadership position and position the manufacturing in the U.S. in a better way would be stronger vehicle regulations like what we see in Europe and China, as well as continued and sustained support for consumer incentives. And from what we're hearing and what we're reading, those do appear to be in play for what could happen in administrative actions or within following political action with legislation.
But it doesn't seem like $7.5 billion for 500,000 charging stations and $7.5 billion to change buses and school buses to electric is very much, you know, minor down payment, isn't it?
It is a good start. It is a lot of money right now that is more than what we are seeing flowing into that space. Charging infrastructure isn't everything, but it is an important element of the transition to electric vehicles. I think to put that in perspective, something like $1 billion per year is already flowing into charging infrastructure. The major way that money is flowing is through electric power utilities that have a mutual interest in making sure that they are planning for charging infrastructure at homes and in public settings to be put in the right spot to charge electric vehicles and make sure they do grid upgrades. And so it's been okay, but that federal money will be hugely helpful to fill in a lot of gaps. And there's lots of private money flowing into that space too. So it is important. I wouldn't want to downplay it too much, but the much more important actions are regulatory policy to move the auto industry to make the much bigger investments, as well as support for consumers to make sure that they're aware and understand the benefits of electric vehicles.
But the study that you just released points out that the United States share of the cumulative global electric vehicle production decreased from 20% to 18% since 2010, and only 15% of the approximately $345 billion in global automaker electric vehicle investments are flowing to the United States. So that is where the focus of our conversation might now go, because as I say, we're told that we're in a competitive environment here, but why are the Chinese and the Europeans surging ahead? What's the problem with the lag in U.S. investments in electric vehicles? I thought they were all the rage.
They certainly are, and we're hearing pretty much every month a new announcement from an automaker saying they're moving to electric vehicles. But I think when it comes down to it, those manufacturing decisions are driven by the regulatory environment. The same companies that are saying they're going to go to 100% electric are either a little uncertain on the time frame, or when they are, the time frame is very far out, like 2030, 2035. And that leaves a lot of ambiguity. And many of those companies are slow to invest. And they're especially slow to invest in the U.S. because the regulatory standards for emissions and for fuel efficiency in the U.S. are substantially weaker than what we see in Europe and China. So that's where a lot of the investments are flowing. So it really shows the power of those regulatory policies to drive more investment into the space and really accelerate the move to these vehicles that have zero emissions at the tailpipe.
Well, but of the 10 million cumulative electric vehicles sold globally, the United States market has fewer than 360,000 electric vehicle sales annually from 2018 through 2020, whereas Europe saw explosive growth from 390,000 to more than 1.3 million, and China grew from 1 million to more than 1.25 million over the same period. So what's the problem here in the United States?
Well, we've went through a bit of a period for the last 4 years when all the policy shifts at the federal level were to make weaker and laxer regulatory standards for the automakers, and those standards really lapsed in a substantial way compared to the steady improvements we had seen in Europe and in China. Those regulations in both of those two major markets that are both the same size or larger than the U.S. Really required that the automakers invested more and deployed more electric vehicles into the marketplace. And in terms of just what products are being offered, now there are a few dozen electric vehicles made available in the U.S., but there are 50 and over 100 electric vehicle models that are unique models in higher volume available in Europe and China. And the more that those models are put out there in higher volumes, the costs are lower, the technology keeps improving, the range is higher. And so once the regulations push the deployment to a higher level, consumers benefit from having a lot more electric vehicle options. And what we're seeing in Europe and China, they're going to buy them. They like those vehicles. They have great acceleration. They save a lot of fuel costs. And increasingly, they're looking like a pretty similar price at the dealership once they're made available. But it really starts from having a regulatory policy that makes more vehicles available.
And again, I'm speaking with Nick Lutze, who directs the International Council on Clean Transportation's Electric Vehicle Program and manages its role as the Secretariat for the International Zero Emission Vehicle Alliance. Previously, with the California Air Resources Board, he participated in the regulatory development of the 2004 and 2012 greenhouse gas emissions regulations for automobiles, and he's the co-author of a new study at the International Council on Clean Transportation, Power Play, evaluating the U.S. position in the global electric vehicle transition. So the Europeans, one out of nine of every new car sold in Europe last year was an electric or a plug-in hybrid vehicle. And this uptick in electric car sales caused a 12% drop in average CO2 emissions of new cars sold in Europe last year. So there you have the cause and effect. So what you've just told us essentially, Nick, is that during the Trump administration, the move towards electric vehicles was rolled back. That was all pretty evident. So are we playing catch up? How long before we'll be catching up, if ever, to the Europeans and the Chinese?
Well, we're at a moment here, Ian. It's a very important moment. As you alluded to in the introduction, the Biden administration is looking at all these different policies, not just the charging infrastructure, but also the vehicle emission regulations. And the first move that they've already made is to reinstate the authority of states like California to set their own emission standards and make sure that their air is going to be cleaner and they can meet their climate goals. Their next move that they've already made is to reinstate emission standards that are stronger than the Trump rollback. And that's just the near-term standards that would go through the year 2026. And what remains is then what do they do for the standards that follow that? The standards that follow that, that go to 2030 or beyond, are really where the market is going to see a huge uptake in electric vehicles globally. But we don't know yet. It really depends on the regulations in the U.S. if we'll see that same sort of electric vehicle uptake like we've already started to see in Europe, like we've started to see in China. There already are stronger policies in those two markets, but with the Biden administration, their first cleaning house with the rolled back regulations that the Trump administration did. And then following that, we all very much expect them to set stronger standards that go to 2030 or beyond that would really start to make electric vehicles mainstream. And that would be really the launch of a large electric vehicle market. And that would be where we would see the US, Europe, and China in what could be seen as a friendly competition, where all the companies that are global in nature, they're making vehicles in all the different markets, but they would all be putting their best technology in all three of those regions. And that would be a win for all of the markets. The more that these companies get to higher volume faster, they get to a point where they make profits off of electric vehicles, and we get to a world that has just as many electric vehicle options available to us today as we have for conventional vehicles today. We will get to that point, but it really requires that the companies get to the high volumes of conventional gasoline and diesel vehicles today in electric vehicles as fast as possible.
Well, your report indicates that of the seven U.S. electric vehicle-only assembly plants representing about 16% of U.S. vehicle production and capacity, three are owned by General Motors, two by Tesla, and one each by emerging electric vehicle companies Rivian and Lucid Motors, and that five automakers, Ford, Fiat, Chrysler, Toyota, Honda, and Nissan, that each produce about 900,000 to 1.5 million vehicles annually in the United States, have not announced plans for EV-only assembly plants. Is that true? Although I believe Ford has a electric Mustang. So that's not good news. I mean, why are those Ford, Fiat, Chrysler, Toyota, Honda, and Nissan not jumping aboard the electric vehicle bandwagon?
You're right. That's bad news indeed for the transition to cleaner vehicles. That was one of the main reasons why we undertook the research. We wanted to see what all the companies had been saying in terms of generally saying we're all in on an all-electric future, that the future is electric and we're leaders in the space. And every automaker has said some version of that, and we wanted to square that with what investments are being made on the ground, where are those investments being made, and indeed, the companies you mentioned and more, there's Fiat, Chrysler, Ford, Toyota, Honda, they all have 4 to 7 auto plants in the U.S., and they have not stated that they will move that plant to electric. They have not made the investments to move that plant to electric. I think it's safe to say they are waiting for new signals in terms of the policies that are coming in the years ahead, that they tend to be doing everything they can to limit their capital expenditures, minimizing their risk. And in a world that doesn't have any real policy requirement to make electric vehicles, they were in a position of waiting, really, for the last 4 years. And now they're seeing that policy will be requiring that they move to cleaner vehicles. And I think we'll see what we saw in China and Europe once those policies were in place. And incentives and charging infrastructure investments were being made, then they will see the signals that they need to see to make those investments. So I think they will get there, but at present, that's why we did the research. And unfortunately, we found that these companies really are lagging in their U.S. investments.
So Trump gave them the permission not to invest in electric and in future non-polluting vehicles, but rather to go back to gas guzzlers. And that nobody quite knows why he did that, but he has some peculiarities. He thinks that windmills are terrible, and it's true that windmills do kill birds, but that's certainly not a reason not to go to clean energy. So is Biden going to do the opposite of what Trump did? If Trump gave those vehicle manufacturers a position to sit on their hands and to stick with old technology, is Biden, sounds like his responsibility is to go double down in the opposite direction. And has it not happened yet? Is it all just PR talk and press releases? I mean, that's what it seems to be.
Yeah, it certainly seems that way. All indications, all statements during the campaign to be elected and since being elected show that the Biden administration has two really serious focuses that are relevant here to the conversation. And that's that commitment to manufacturing in the United States is really a central pillar of his support and what he believes is the right path for America. And the second main focus is climate change. It was a major driver in terms of his constituency and what he had stated as a main goal for the administration. And both of those focuses of climate change and U.S. manufacturing really converge on this specific question. And so it does appear clear from all the statements and all the actions so far that the administration will move to much stronger policy. I alluded to it. It takes a little bit of time to untangle the legal web of the Trump administration's rollback. So, you know, I think I can offer a little bit of understanding in terms of just it takes time to work through that particular set of legal and regulatory steps before they can move to a stronger, longer term regulation. But all indications from what they're saying is that they will move to a stronger regulation once they do clean up the mess that was created from the Trump administration rolling back the previous regulations for weaker 2026 standards. But I think the administration will put the auto industry on a much stronger path that has far lower emissions and a lot more electric vehicles after that point.
Well, Nick Latzey, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Likewise. Thanks, Ian. Take care.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Nick Latzey, who directs the International Council on Clean Transportation's Electric Vehicle Program and manages its role as the Secretariat of the International Zero Emissions Vehicle Alliance. Previously with the California Air Resources Board, he participated in the regulatory development of the 2004 and 2012 greenhouse gas emissions regulations for automobiles, and he's the co-author of a new study at the International Council on Clean Transportation Power Play, evaluating the U.S. position in the global electric vehicle transition. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the 40-year-old building in Florida that collapsed was not constructed with materials to stand up to saltwater intrusion from rising sea levels that corrodes concrete and steel foundations. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Xiongren Peng, who is a professor and the director of the International Center for Adaptation Planning and Design in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Florida, where he conducts research in adaptation planning for climate change like sea level rise and extreme weather. Welcome to Background Briefing, Xiongren Peng.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us. And it sounds like global warming and the rising sea level is a factor in the collapse of this building in Florida, where there are still 150 residents of that building missing under the rubble. It's on a barrier island. There's been an 8-inch rise in sea level since it was built 40 years ago. And it's sitting on limestone that's very porous and allows seawater to infiltrate. So in terms of the 2018 engineering report that warned of significant cracks and breaks in the concrete and that design flaws and deteriorating waterproofing would cause exponential damage via the expansion of these cracks, are we talking about water that comes from rain from the roof or water that comes from underneath through the seepage of seawater through the limestone? Is it one or the other or both?
Yeah, I will suspect that's both. Yeah.
It's both
of them are because it's the sea close to the ocean and it has seawater, so it has salt. And the salt is bad to the concrete and to the steel. It will cause corrosion.
I see.
But it's too early to say that what exactly cause of the collapse. But definitely in that environment, this is a factor that we need to check.
So the seawall is very corrosive, is it not? Both on cement and on steel.
Yes, it is.
So what kind of rules or regulations are there in terms of buildings now in Florida, given that regularly salt water seeps up through stormwater drains regularly, and the previous governor, Scott, wouldn't allow anybody in his state government to even use the word climate change, and he referred to this regular flooding with king tides as nuisance flooding. The current governor, DeSantis, says he's not a global warming denier, but he's also not a global warming believer. As a structural engineer, what kind of atmosphere are you working in Florida? Do professional people, in terms of building these buildings and maintaining them and protecting their residents, are they aware of rising sea level caused by global warming?
Okay. First of all, I'm not a structural engineer. I'm an urban planner.
Right.
Regarding the state government, actually last year, they passed a new law that they require all the public funded construction on the coastline to conduct a sea level rise impact projection study to analyze the vulnerability of the new construction. So I think that is a good law, and that's a very good step towards governing the coast area new development. But that is only apply to government funded projects. I think it should equally apply to all new development in the coastal area. Because two things. One, if we know that some areas is very vulnerable and it will be inundated in the next 20, 50 years, we need to discuss whether we should even allow new development to build. Second is we need to also examine the efficacy of the building code and zoning code to see if this building code is still applicable given the reality of sea level rise and salt water intrusion. Because the building code, when they updated after Hurricane Andrew, was mainly respond to strong winds, hurricanes, and storms, but gave less consideration of the sea level rise. So I think it may be a time to reconsider, at least reevaluate the efficacy of the building code in the coast area, particularly in Florida.
Well, the oceans are expected to rise in Florida, another 17 inches of sea level expected by 2040. So given that you're in the planning business, is planning underway for that sea level rise? It would seem to me at a certain point, these barrier islands simply cannot sustain these kind of tall buildings. I mean, limestone is porous. It's subject to saltwater seepage. The buildings shift at any rate. The ground shifts under it. So at what point do you think people have got to realize that it's just not viable to have these tall buildings along the barrier islands?
Yes. So this is a constant discussion among the planning professionals, you know, to talk about whether it's necessary to allow new building in those kind of situation. But there's another force that there's a lot of demand for oceanfront living. People like the oceanfront view, the ocean view, and living high-rise buildings. So there should be a balance, or at least have a conversation right now between the planners, the government agencies, as well as the citizens and developers, to have that kind of discussion. First of all, whether we allow it to those new buildings. Second is who is going to pay for it. If there is a catastrophic event, who is going to pay for it? And the third one is what's the impact on the cities' infrastructure, particularly finance of the new infrastructure.
Well, less than 3 months before this building collapsed, the president of the Condominium Association warned the owners in a letter that the damage to the building had gotten significantly worse since that 2018 inspection that I mentioned earlier. And this letter was written by Gene Wodnicki, the president of the association's board of directors. And she was explaining why there was a list of extensive construction projects that would cost about $15 million. But the residents were asked to pay for that, not the owner of the building. How come the residents are responsible for fixing a building?
That's a conversation. It's getting to the equity issues that has to be between the building owner and the residents. But the more important question to ask is, we should, you know, what kind of information we give out when we sell the property or sell the condominium. Okay, so right now we don't give out environment risk in terms of sea level rise. We don't give out that information. So the buyers are not really aware of, probably not aware of the environment potential disasters there. So we should make it mandatory for all the property sales in the coastal areas for the potential buyer to understand the potential risk. And so that will give them at least some pre-warning that what they are getting into. But right now, that information is not available and is not made available to the potential buyers.
And again, I'm speaking with Zhongreng Peng, who is a professor and the director of the International Center for Adaptation Planning and Design in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Florida, where he conducts research in adaptation planning for climate change like sea level rise and extreme weather. Well, it is obviously now vitally important, isn't it? I mean, it's a terrible situation where you've got 150 people presumably dead underneath that pile of rubble, and the whole building itself is very insecure, the rest of the building, and they're having a hard time dealing with the rubble because the building itself, the rest of the building could collapse. So this must be a major wake-up call. What are you hearing from your colleagues in planning, etc.? Do they recognize that this is just the beginning of what would seem to be a series of problems that they're going to have with buildings that are at least 40 years old?
Yeah. There are lots of discussion among the planning community. There are several issues we're talking about. So we don't know exactly what's the cause of the specific collapse on this building, condo building. But even it end up like we find some, you know, structural failures, it's not related to sea level rise. But still, the threat from the sea level rise and saltwater intrusion is real. And so we needed to have a complete auditor of all the buildings 30 or 40 years or older, because those buildings were built at the times that have different kind of technology, different knowledge from what we know right now. And so that's the first thing. The second thing is, as I said before, the buyers, when they get into buyers' buildings, they are not made aware what is the potential problem of the property. And in the end, you know, how much they are going to expect to pay. So those information needed to be transparent. And thirdly, we needed to re-examine the zoning laws and land use plans in the reality of sea level rise, to see if some of the zoning we need to change because of the sea level rise. Because when we first do the zoning, it's many years ago, sea level rise is not an obvious issue. So we really needed to re-examine those land use plans, the comprehensive plans, and the zoning laws. Another thing is we talk about adaptation planning. It's like, how do we adapt to it? You know, there are different ways to adapt to the sea level rise. One is we can build, but with a stronger building code. Second is we have a, we just say those areas are not applicable, appropriate for new development. Then we just say don't, so not for development. Third one is, what kind of new technology we should use, like the elevated roads or elevated buildings that for future development. So those are the issues that we need to consider. And the most also most important issue is also who is going to pay for it. The willingness to pay is a big issue.
Well, presumably there'll be some massive lawsuits. I don't know exactly against who, presumably against the building owners, but the president is, Biden will be there on Thursday. He spoke with Governor DeSantis on Friday and offered a lot of help from FEMA, and they've sent teams down there. But the White House press secretary said today that President Biden believes that there should be an investigation into the collapse. Obviously, that's going to happen. But what would you recommend in terms of what a president might offer as solutions here, not just to take care of this problem and the loss of all these people and comforting the next of kin, which is what Biden will be doing on Thursday. But clearly, there's got to be some, as you say, you keep using the word transparency. Well, that at least is a place to start, right?
Right. Yes. So I think, for President Biden right now, it's focused on climate change mitigation. That means minimize the greenhouse gas emission to the air. That is good. That will be reduce the greenhouse gas in the air. On the other hand, however, the greenhouse gas already in the air, what are you going to do with that? So that climate change will continue even though we want to reduce the greenhouse gas emission. So that's another way to handle it is through climate adaptation. So the adaptation needed to be have a leadership at the national level and state level. Right now, all the adaptation is locally. The local government is doing piece by pieces. How do we adapt to it? Like in some places, elevated the road, improve the sewage system and so on. And in Miami Beach, they buy some pump, you pump the water out. So those are small scale adaptation. But we need to have a national leadership on to support the local government in the coastal areas to take active steps to make adaptation plans and take adaptive measures. So to respond to the sea level rise and climate change in the coastal area. Probably in the national level, not only to the coastal area, but to other areas as well. Like right now, the heat wave in the northwest areas. So if we have to talk about, in terms of planning, in terms of design, and in terms of other mechanisms, how do we adapt to extreme heat? So extreme weather, extreme heat and extreme precipitations and sea level rise, those are common. It will come very more and more frequent. And then the question is, how do we adapt to it? And I think this should be a national dialogue on this important issue. And I hope that President Biden will address those issues.
Well, Zhong Renpeng, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I'll be speaking with Zhong Renpeng, who is a professor and the director of the International Center for Adaptation Planning and Design in the Department of Urban and Regional Planning at the University of Florida, where he conducts research in adaptation planning for climate change, like sea level rise and extreme weather. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Bye.